Quarter. He's won many awards, and justifiably so, the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting, and he is... Well, Blackwater is his first book. I'm sure in his life he will have many. He's such a young guy to have done all of this. I just find it something. And he happens to be from Milwaukee as well. We're going to talk. He's written recently, if you go to The Nation, he's written some interesting challenges to both the Obama and Clinton campaigns on plans to end the war in Iraq and what their plans are. We'll, of course, talk about the milestone of 4,000 U.S. troops killed in Iraq and ask about the number of Iraqi civilians who have been killed there. The soldier war hearings, which we have not talked about just in passing, which just took place. He said they were extraordinary. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney's comments concerning the Iraq war and welcome your phone calls as well. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Hello, Jeremy. Thanks again so much for being with us.
I feel like I'm coming to my living room when I come back to Milwaukee and I come into your studio, Kathleen.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you here as always, and thank you for all the work you've done. You wrote an interesting piece. Let's start with the campaign because we're so much on the campaign, and then we'll talk about the presidential comments. You have a challenge to both the Obama and Clinton camps, and it concerns Iraq and what their plans are, and you say that neither one of them is going far enough.
Right. I mean, I think most people at this point know that John McCain is quite publicly running on a platform of four more years of the Bush policy. Certainly when it comes to Iraq, he's definitely falling more in line with the Bush policy domestically, despite his talk of the Straight Talk Express, et cetera, and really trying to shore up the support of the so-called base, the Christian conservatives, et cetera. And McCain has made clear he wants to keep troops in Iraq perhaps until they're all as old as he is. But the reality is that when you look at Senator Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton, their rhetoric on the campaign trail is very strong rhetoric of ending the war. I think the vast majority of the people that are out there filling those stadiums for Barack Obama, going to Hillary Clinton's rallies, those are people that genuinely believe this has been a disastrous war and they want it to come to an end. And I think in the case of Obama, you see the most clear expression of hope from his voters that he's going to end that war. Now, when you unpack it a little bit, and this is how I got into this story, you realize that both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have plans which you really couldn't characterize as plans to end the occupation. It's to transfer the mission of the U.S. in Iraq to a rebranded or repackaged operation on the ground. And what I mean by that is this. The Bush administration right now has about 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Barack Obama has a plan to pull out U.S. combat brigades in the scope of about one to two a month over the course of between 10 and 16 months. And so there's no doubt Obama has an intention to significantly reduce the number of fighting forces in Iraq. And Hillary Clinton's plan is similar, except she doesn't hold it to as tight of a timetable as Obama. What I've focused in on, Kathleen, is what they say they're going to leave behind. Both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have Iraq plans that are largely based on the Iraq Study Group, the Baker-Hamilton report that came out a couple of years ago, which Bush basically ignored, and the 2007 Defense Supplemental Bill that was portrayed as the Democrats' withdrawal plan. And what it says is this, and this is Obama's plan in a nutshell. We're going to pull out those combat brigades, but we're going to leave in place the Green Zone, which is massive and has tens of thousands of personnel operating, both military and civilian. We're going to keep control of the Baghdad International Airport. We're going to keep this monstrous U.S. embassy, the largest of any embassy of any country in world history. And perhaps most disturbing, Obama says he's going to keep a strike force in place to strike at Al-Qaeda and to reserve the right to strike at Al-Qaeda if it develops a base in Iraq. Now, the military analysts I've been talking to say that that could result in a troop deployment in Iraq, a sustained presence of between 20 and 80,000 troops for the foreseeable future. These are just forces that Obama is saying he will not withdraw. This is part of his stabilization mission. And so what that means is that contractors, which I've written about, Blackwater and others, now number at a one-to-one ratio with U.S. soldiers. In fact, right now, there's actually a greater number of so-called private contractors in Iraq than there are U.S. soldiers. There's 180,000 contractors, 160,000. Now, as you know, not all of those are armed contractors. Some of them are truck drivers or cooks or doing laundry. So the reality is, though, that Barack Obama, despite the rhetoric of withdrawal, could well keep a place in place a force that numbers over 100,000 U.S. personnel. Hillary Clinton's plan is, I think, a little bit worse than Barack Obama's because it's much more open-ended for the combat brigades. But both of them have plans to maintain quite a serious level of U.S. Presence, armed presence inside of Iraq.
I know that you're speaking out on this. Not too many people are. You have written that it would mean a pledge to swiftly withdraw all U.S. troops and contractors if they want to end the occupation. That should be the plan.
Right. I mean, you mentioned the Winter Soldier hearings at the beginning of this, and I actually think it's important to bring that up right now. The Winter Soldier hearings, which were held over the weekend of March 15th in Silver Spring, Maryland, I was asked to come in and give testimony on the issue of private contractors, but people like me were in the minority there. It was 250 Iraq and Afghanistan war vets who came together at this historic gathering to tell very harrowing stories of their time on the front line and to give public testimony about horrifying things that they either themselves did or witnessed and failed to stop, or it was their experiences interacting with Iraqi civilians who were being, in the words of the Iraq war vets, dehumanized, turned into something other than human beings. These 250 Iraq and Afghanistan war vets are part of a coalition that's growing of now 850 Iraq and Afghanistan war vets who have come out with very clear demands. They say that the only way to end the war in Iraq is immediate, unconditional withdrawal of all U.S. troops and contractors from Iraq. Now, when someone in the anti-war movement says that, or the so-called peaceniks or the out-now people say that, they're dismissed by the political campaigns of Obama and Hillary Clinton as being naive. We broke it, we bought it in Iraq. Those calls cannot be so readily pushed away when they're coming from those who have served or continue to serve on the front lines. And in my analysis of the situation, both from talking to Iraqi civilians as well as these U.S. soldiers, is that that is the only real way that we can end this war. And that is not the position of Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton right now. And so when you mention a challenge at the beginning, my challenge to people is this. I have many friends who are in love with Barack Obama. I'm not trying to break off their engagement. Same thing with Hillary Clinton. I'm just asking them to cheat on them a little bit with conscience on the war and to come out and say to them, look, I'm giving you money. I'm coming to your rallies. When you were in Wisconsin, I voted for you. But I want something now. Before you become crowned as the nominee, I want you to make a much more serious pledge to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq. This is a moment, I think, where we could energize people in this country who are really disturbed about the state of affairs in the war. And I think the direction at this point for those people against the war should come from those veterans who were there, who are coming back and very clearly saying, we are not supporting a candidate. Our issue is not who wins in November. Our issue is ending the war. And they know how to do it because they've been there.
And we've talked about the fact that the war has not been front and center as far as the press is concerned for the past few months until we hit the 4,000 U.S.
Right.
Dead in Iraq. You asked, and this is, well, let me ask you first, why that's the case? Why those hearings were hardly touched by the press? Yeah. I don't think people know about those.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the people that did pay attention to those hearings were largely people from the very right-wing media in this country to attack them as being traitors. There was a small demonstration of people who were vets from Vietnam or Korea who showed up and were sort of booing people as they went in and calling them traitors. And you're like John Kerry, who, you know, revealed U.S. war crimes in Vietnam decades ago. But I think that there's a couple of things at play here. One is the general culture of our media in this country. I mean, we're talking right now, Kathleen, on public airwaves. And I'm honored to be here to talk about Frank Zeidler because he was a major defender and promoter of public media.
Yes, he was.
But we have an unprecedented level of media consolidation in this country where media outlets are looking at what brings in the biggest advertising revenue. And it's not international news. It's not people dying in Iraq. It's what clinic has Britney Spears checked herself into. I bet more Americans know what's going on with Britney Spears right now than know the fact that a million Iraqis have died since the beginning of the U.S. Invasion. But I also think that there's something else at play here when it comes to these veterans. It's too complicated for the discourse that's being encouraged right now in the United States. To have these kinds of soldiers that have a very nuanced view of the war in Iraq takes time to unpack. The other thing is that a lot of these guys are, I look at them, I was saying this to you before, I'm 33 years old. I watched these guys get up there and talk, and I felt like they were kids. You know, and in reality, a lot of them are. They're 20 years old. Some of them are 21. Some of them, their entire life experience was, I grew up in a rural community, and I met a young guy from Milwaukee who was there. He told me two of the other veterans from Wisconsin couldn't come because they have such severe post-traumatic stress disorder. One of them had to check themselves into the VA hospital. And so you watch them, and you realize maybe the only time in their lives that they've gotten up and given a public speech was in high school at a speech class. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they're up there now talking about how they choked an old Iraqi man, they kicked someone, they threw a bag disguised as food rations but really had feces in it at children on the side of the road. Some of them had killed people, and they had a picture of themselves the day that they had carried out their first kill. And they're giving this testimony. It's too hot for television to hear about crimes being committed by U.S. forces in Iraq. That's an untouchable subject in the U.S. media right now. We don't see that playing out on the pages of our newspapers. People don't want that with their morning coffee, Kathleen.
Yeah. 1 million Iraqi civilians?
I think that's actually a conservative estimate.
Really?
And it's not 1 million Iraqi civilians who have been killed by U.S. soldiers. It's 1 million Iraqis who have died as a result of violent action or curable disease that has been a result of a destruction of Iraq's hospitals and civil society since the beginning of the invasion. I mean, we're talking about 60% of households in Iraq, according to the latest polls there, have lost a family member. It's a country of 27 million people. So you have about a million who have died, about 600,000 of them from violent death. You have about 4 million people who are either internally displaced in Iraq or are living in Jordan and Syria as refugees. When you add it up, about half of Iraq's 27 million people are either internally displaced, refugees, dead, or in serious need of medical attention. And so when we hear the president and the vice president waxing poetic about the success of the surge, we need to understand that the half of the country is basically dead or disabled in a sense, or is out of the country. And in Anbar province, where they've declared this great victory, they have to actually pay people not to shoot at American soldiers. I mean, anyone who thinks that the Iraq policy is a success right now is only paying attention to the Journal Sentinel.
What did you make of Vice President Cheney's comments, which raised a few eyebrows? I'm surprised more isn't made of this when we hit 4,000 mark. Martha Raddatz asked him about public opinion polls, which have shown for years now that the public is not behind this.
Yeah.
And she mentioned three quarters of the American public, and his answer was so.
Right. Well, I mean, this is nothing, I think, shocks us anymore that Dick Cheney says or does. It's a sad commentary on the state of affairs in this country that we've just come to expect this from Dick Cheney. What I thought was even more insulting to military families was what Dick Cheney said when he was informed that the 4,000th American soldier had died in Iraq. He said, well, they volunteered to put on the uniform. Right, unlike you, Mr. Cheney. And Bush was somehow defending the United States from the Viet Cong by evading service in the National Guard down south in the United States. I mean, I think that to have these two people running this policy and Bush the other week telling soldiers in Afghanistan that he really envies them and wishes he could be part of that kind of action. When he had a chance to be a part of that action, he wasn't. And I think a lot of Americans feel that this cowboy, flippant way of talking about soldier deaths in Iraq is deeply insulting to people in this country who are increasingly wary or against the war in Iraq, many of whom have family members that are there that are kids that signed up either to fight floods with the National Guard or to get a college education. Yes, they signed up for the Army. In a sense, you can say they knew what they were getting into, as Cheney so callously pointed out. But the reality is that they are now fighting a war that the vast majority of the people from their home country are against. And to make those kinds of comments, well, they volunteered for it, is almost to say to military families, your loved one deserves it for being a part of our stupid war and putting on that uniform in the first place. I mean, if I were a pro-war American and had a loved one serving in the military, I would be so deeply offended at Dick Cheney's comments right now, especially given that the Bush twins are running around having a great time in life, having nothing to do with deployment over there. The vast majority of congresspeople, their children aren't serving in the war in Iraq. I think McCain is one of the only people in the U.S. Congress who has a child serving in the war zone.
Yeah. And yet there is a great fear, as you know, and we hear this expressed, that things could get worse if we left. I was interested in the interview you did with the author of Beyond the Green Zone when you asked him the question. Let me ask you the question. I'm interested in his response and yours. What would happen if the U.S. did withdraw immediately from Iraq?
I don't take this question lightly because I don't think it's as simple as everything all of a sudden is going to be fine and the Iraqis are going to work everything else out themselves. I think there was a period in Iraq years ago, 10 years ago, where if Saddam Hussein had somehow been taken out, if he was overthrown internally or there was a coup, I do think there would have been some way toward a relatively quick peaceful resolution to things inside of Iraq. Now, and the anti-war movement needs to understand this, now there's a very different situation on the ground in Iraq. The United States has fanned the flames of ethnic and sectarian tensions and violence. Iraq, for decades, has had a fiercely secular tradition. That's true. That's not so true right now. Baghdad, for instance, has been ethnically cleansed. It was a ethnically diverse city. Now the vast majority of its residents are Shiites, and you have death squads hunting various ethnic communities. And so I put all of that out on the table, not to make a case that the United States and Iraq, but to say that we have a very complicated dynamic right now. And what is so seldom mentioned when we talk about immediate withdrawal is this fact. The single greatest source of violence in Iraq right now, the single greatest justification for al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is a very tiny presence that the U.S. likes to talk about all the time, and for this sectarian violence is the U.S. occupation. I think it's the arrogance of U.S. policy that says our military presence is somehow going to be the resolving factor to all of this. I think in real political terms, what would happen, Kathleen, if the U.S. pulled out is that we would have an immediate, very frightening and sad outbreak of violence. I think there would be a dramatic power struggle that would take place. But I do think that power would be consolidated regionally in Iraq. And I do believe that Iraqis would form a national government and remain as one country. But the United States has no positive role to play in that. And the fact is that Iraqis are dying in massive numbers while the U.S. military is there. I've talked with many, many Iraqis and Iraqi Americans, and they say that the only way is for the United States to get out and let us resolve this ourselves. The problem for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, if they win, is that the moment they withdraw one combat brigade in Iraq, if there's a suicide bombing there, the right mm-hmm. is going to jump on them and say, that's why I think it's important for them, get them out of there as fast as possible. Start with the regional diplomacy. Stop, pushing aside the United Nations and casting aspersions on the nations of the world who have engaged in international diplomacy much longer than our country has been a nation state. I think we need to back off this arrogance and support self-determination of the Iraqi people.
Do you imagine, because there is quite a difference between Republican and Democratic plans for Iraq, that we will see this be much more part of the national discussion after we get nominee for the Democrats?
My honest answer to that is I don't know. I would hope that would be the case. I just don't know. I think that there will be an immediate sort of incursion of journalists into Iraq after if a Democrat wins, because people are going to want to do all of these stories. How are Iraqis reacting to Obama becoming president or Hillary becoming president? I think that would be the case too if McCain became president. But I think now this is so we have, and I think it's embarrassing to say that this is the phrase that I think sort of permeates media discussions in this country: Iraq fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a war where over a million Iraqis have died, 4,000 Americans have died. The United States military is stretched thin. We're talking about a $3 trillion war, and it's like, page 12 news, if it even is in the papers at all. The cynic in me says I think that would continue on. The hoper in me says that I would hope that we're better than that, that we'll actually start to step up and take responsibility for it. But the cynicism of our leaders, and they put on the uniform or the so part of it. The only way we can combat that right now is by saying there's nothing we can do about them. But there is something we can do in this immediate moment to ensure that that is not the national dynamic January 20th, 2009.
Jeremy Scahill is our guest this hour, and we're going to welcome phone calls. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. Jeremy Scahill is giving the Frank Zeidler Memorial Address. It's the first of these, appropriately, because he started a lot of the library branches and was concerned about war and peace issues. Jeremy is going to be speaking at 7:30 tonight at Central Library in downtown Milwaukee. I've even said on the air that library should be named after Frank Zeidler, too. The Frank Zeidler Central Memorial Library. We'll just say that's what we're calling it today.
I still have some overdue books from my childhood, so I have to dig those up tonight.
Bring them in today. They'll give you a pass. He's an international journalist, of course, and author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeremy Scahill is our guest, and we go to phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Ed from Dodgeville, our first caller. Jeremy, hi, Ed.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. My question was, after what he was saying, and I was just, the radio was in the background. I had no idea about Hillary Clinton's plans or Barack's plans for the war if they were elected. So my question is, what about Ron Paul?
Well, I mean, the fact is that Ron Paul himself has now taken himself out of the race. One of the things that I think was interesting about Ron Paul's candidacy was that, and I travel a lot around this country, there are a lot of young people that were really excited about Ron Paul's campaign. And I think it injected a necessary component of the anti-war sentiment into the Republican debates. I think that what Ron Paul was able to do in the Republican debates was to bring a level of seriousness about the war that is almost always absent from these sort of fairy tale discussions among the Republicans about how great things are in Iraq. So I do think that there was a positive role that was played by Ron Paul in those debates, as there was an incredibly positive role played by Dennis Kucinich in the Democratic debates. The issue in this country, though, is that there's a marginalization of political figures that is inherent to our political system who have something to say outside of the dominant parameters of the debate. And I think it's important to welcome a much more participatory electoral system in this country to encourage third parties to run, et cetera. But, I mean, you know, in real political terms right now, I think that the energies need to be focused on pressing those candidates who are out there. And one of these guys is going to win, and we have an opportunity right now to push them as hard as we can before that time comes. But thank you for your call.
Thanks for the call. Zach from Green Bay. Hi, Zach.
Good morning. I just wanted to share a comment which I found very disgusting when I observed this last week when they were when the CBS News was covering the fifth anniversary of the war, and Katie Couric was going over the basic statistics. She, in a very deadpan and unquestioning way, you know, mentioned that there were an estimated 85,000 Iraqi dead. Period. You know, absolutely excluding the estimates of an extremely respected John Hopkins University, which I believe their estimates went from 400,000 to 1 million dead, and that estimate is already a year old.
Right.
And I think it just speaks to the myth of the liberal mainstream media, and that's basically what I wanted to share.
All right, Zach, thank you.
Well, I mean, I remember about a year ago there was a poll conducted by the Associated Press and Ipsos, and it found that a majority of Americans believe that less than 10,000 Iraqis had died in the war. Bush himself, at one point about a year ago, said he thought it was 30,000. And the Johns Hopkins study that you're referring to also was in collaboration with the Lancet, the respected British medical journal. And I believe now it's over a year ago, it was about 655,000 Iraqis dead. I knew this from the 90s, so I think it's important to raise those numbers because it shows the sheer atrocity of the whole thing. I mean, if we think about that, Iraq's a country of 27 million people. If a million of its people have died since the beginning of the U.S. invasion, that's about 600,000 more than Saddam Hussein is alleged to have killed during his entire time in power. And I think, to me, one of the most stunning statements I've heard since this invasion began is that the majority of Iraqis say it was better under Saddam Hussein. Kathleen, I was there when Saddam Hussein was president. I met people who had their tongues cut out for saying the wrong things. Their children would go to school and make a statement like we all make on the playground, well, my dad is smarter than yours, or my dad's smarter than the president. Your dad is smarter than the president. Next thing you know, the secret police are at your parents' house. There was a state of terror in Iraq, but people could walk down the street. They didn't have any freedom of speech, and they don't have it right now either. But they had some sense of security when Saddam was there. I was just in California with a group of Iraqi Americans who grew up in Saddam's Iraq, and they were all saying, you know, we look back now, and it sort of seems like paradise. And we don't say that lightly. And I think that the numbers the caller raises, the fact that people like Katie Couric, and it's not just Katie Couric. When do you ever see any mention of how many Iraqis were killed? We hear about U.S. soldiers being killed. I don't think we hear about it enough, actually. But we never hear about Iraqi civilians dying, except by sectarian violence. That's a, you know, if you're watching the news here, you would think U.S. soldiers are dying and Iraqis are just butchering each other left and right. The U.S. military never kills anyone except insurgents.
Let's go back to the contractors for just a moment. After your extraordinary book, after an outrage in this country, after hearings in Congress, I was amazed to hear you say that it's still a one-to-one ratio, although probably slightly more greater. Private contractors.
Right.
What happened?
Well, I mean, we're in the midst of the most radical. I feel like I've said this on your show every time I've been here, and it becomes more and more true every day. We are in the midst of the most radical privatization agenda in the history of our nation, and we are seeing it in its most vivid form with the war in Iraq. There are about 182,000 contractors in Iraq right now. About 140,000 of those work for the Pentagon, and the remainder work for a combination of other federal agencies like the State Department, for instance, which is the major employer of Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and DynCorp, the three main mercenary companies that are working for the U.S. In Iraq. And the reality is, and David Petraeus has said this, Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador, has said this, that without these contractors, the war would not be sustainable. The Chilean ambassador to the U.N. has a new book that's going to come out next month, and he talks about, in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, how the Bush administration tried to bully and blackmail smaller nations that had seats, rotating seats on the Security Council, like Mexico and Chile, into supporting the invasion. And I bring that up because here's the point. If you don't have nation-state support, if you can't get other countries to send in thousands and thousands of their troops, and you want to wage a war that's unpopular at home, and you don't want to implement a draft, you need to rent an army. And that's exactly what the Bush administration has done. So there's a handful of countries that are providing some nominal token support to Bush, primarily for economic reasons or reasons of not wanting to offend the United States. The economies are too dependent on it, or their protection. And so instead, Bush has 630 corporations that are right now at this moment operating in Iraq.
630?
630 corporations, 182,000 personnel, drawing people from over 100 countries around the world, many of whose home governments are opposed to the war. There are 170 companies in Iraq that are providing mercenary services, private security services, like Blackwater. Blackwater is like the Maserati of the industry, but it's in a pool with 169 other companies. That's almost as many nations as there are registered at the UN. So we talk about, and I think a lot of people in the anti-war movement talk about, well, the point of Iraq was to take Iraq's oil. Okay, but let's look at something deeper here. It's not just a looting of Iraq. It's a looting of the U.S. Treasury as well. So are most Americans aware of the fact that in this $3 trillion war, they're paying for the salaries of employees from 630 corporations with personnel from 100 countries around the world, human rights abuses of these workers happening left and right, the U.S. embassy built on slave labor in Iraq? These things are all being investigated by Henry Waxman, but no one covers them. Only when some salacious little scandal pops up does it even make a blip on the radar. Blackwater kills 17 Iraqis. All of a sudden, it becomes a story. Where were these media outlets for 4 years before that happened?
Ann from Madison, our next caller. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Yeah, we should remember that it's the American taxpayer, but not the companies that are making all the money in Iraq that are paying for these contractors that are doing so much damage. I think the most instructive thing I've done about this whole war is listen to Amy Goodman's 2 days of recorded talks, basically word for word, of veterans who had been in Iraq, some of them for, you know, 3 or even more terms, and some parents who had lost sons or daughters in Iraq. And I think it's too bad Congress wasn't in session. In fact, they'd just gone on Easter vacation at that point, because it was in Silver Spring, Maryland. They could have hopped right over. And I think at some point soon, all members of Congress should be required to listen to those firsthand accounts of what these young men and women, and some of them not so young, actually did to the Iraqis, especially to Iraqi civilians. They feel terrible about them. And I think that post-traumatic stress more often comes from atrocities people have committed themselves than from having suffered from atrocities. The guilt and, you know, their feeling of helplessness and their record of the callous attitude of their superior officers. Just, I mean, it was enough to make me call every congressman and congresswoman and senator on my list
Okay.
Well, you know, I've been as I said earlier. I mean, I testified at the Winter Soldier hearings and spent 3 days among these veterans. And I'll tell you a behind the scenes story from there, Kathleen, that people might find interesting. So there were about 250 veterans there. About 40 or 50 of them actually gave public testimony. And it was not open to the public. And the reason why is because they did disseminate it to the media. They wanted it to get out there. But they didn't want to turn it into a sort of Lollapalooza of the anti-war movement. They wanted it to be somber. And walking around in between the sessions, the lawn at the National Labor Campus where it was held was filled with men and women who had served in Iraq that for the first time in their military careers were meeting someone else who was confirming for them that they are not traitors, that what they're feeling inside about what they had done or seen in Iraq was not wrong, that there were others like them. And so, you know, some of these kids, I keep calling them kids because they seem so young, they spent the entire weekend sitting on the lawn smoking cigarettes and just being happy to feel like they're not crazy, that this isn't something wrong that they've done by speaking out or coming to this or signing the paper or wearing a shirt that says, I'm an Iraq veteran against the war. I found it so incredibly moving. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the media coverage, and John Stauber and others from the Center for Media and Democracy have been pushing MoveOn.org to inform its 3.3 million members that this happened. The media ignored it. Congress ignored it. People can see this testimony at IVAW.org, the website of the Iraq Veterans Against the War. This was one of perhaps the single most important action against the war since the beginning of the invasion. Mm-hmm. And I would say the most credible action against the war because it was actual soldiers, not professional activists. Most of these people, they've never voted before in their lives. They don't want to work for a political campaign. And what I found so deeply moving was that several of them gave harrowing testimony. I mean, I don't know how some of them sleep at night. And at the end of it, they were fighting back tears, bravely fighting back tears, and said, in conclusion, I want to say to the Iraqi people, I'm sorry for what I've done. One guy ripped up his commendation papers he was awarded a medal for honor and bravery by General David Petraeus, and he ripped it up and said, "You're not my general." Why would people in this country not want to hear that? Well, if you're a supporter of the war, it sort of goes against your support the troops rhetoric. Or if you're just sort of walking around and you're upset about the war, but you have other things going on in your life. This is very disturbing. You can't walk away from that and say, no, I'm just going to go on with my life. It's jolting. And I would encourage people to check it out a little bit. Just watch one or two of the sessions. They're short, some of them. One of the most profound things I've ever been a part of in my life, certainly.
And you've been a part of a lot of profound things, Jeremy. All right. Thank you, Ann, for the call. An email from Menominee, Michigan, Dave. I think if we leave this year or next or 20 years from now, Jeremy, no matter when we leave, there will be trouble. What do you think the reasons surrounding countries are not more involved holding Iraq together? Is our government keeping everybody from being involved in some way?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of interesting points raised by this. If you look at Iraq's neighborhood and you look at Jordan, for instance, which neighbors Iraq, Jordan is ruled by King Abdullah, who is a very close ally of the Bush administration. And he is in extraordinary trouble domestically in his country for being perceived to be a part of a crusader war in a neighboring Muslim country. I think that we would see an increase in involvement from neighboring countries in Iraq if there was an international legitimacy to the presence in that country. And I'm not talking about the U.S. military presence. I'm saying if there was an actual international program that was funded by member nations of the United Nations to rebuild Iraq, I do think that you would see a much more positive role being played regionally. But none of these countries want to get in bed with the United States. I mean, look at what happened in Saudi Arabia when they allowed U.S. military operations to come from Saudi Arabia. Attacks, bombs. I mean, Saudi Arabia, that government is viewed as a corrupt monarchy that is close to the Bush administration. We never hear about the gun battles going on throughout Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Saudis are not as stable as they appear. When Mubarak dies in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood could easily take over. What the United States has done is to make forces very powerful throughout the Middle East that will be very hostile to so-called U.S. interests. The reality is perhaps the biggest winner of the U.S. invasion occupation of Iraq has been Iran. I mean, the Iranians fought a bloody 10-year war with Iraq. Now Iran is a major power player and broker inside of Iraq. That's a direct result of the occupation and is outrageous to most Iraqis. And so when the guy writes in and he asks this question, I think it also says the United States needs to leave. I mean, there is a very vibrant diplomatic discussion in the Arab community about this that we hear nothing about, and that it's totally sidelined because there's no such thing as United Nations in that region anymore. It's the United States occupation.
Let's go to more phone calls. Jeremy Scahill is our guest. Let's take a pause, actually, and then we'll be back to more phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. Jeremy Scahill, international journalist, our guest. He is the author, of course, of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He is giving the Frank Zeidler Memorial Address at 7:30 tonight at Central Library in downtown Milwaukee. It is free and open to the public. And he's also a Puffin Fellow, writing fellow at the Nation Institute. Let's go to more phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, you could do that as well. That number or that address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeremy Scahill is our guest. We go to Kathy from Opaca next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you for having this program. Mr. Scahill, I suppose I have the tendency to try to figure out psychological motivations of people, and of course that's a stupid game anyway. But my oldest nephew is a veteran of Iraq. He served two tours of duty there. Unfortunately, he is a career Marine. He's 32 years old now, and he still thinks it was the right war at the right time. He won't be going back because he's on Okinawa now. His father thinks it's still the right war at the right time. He was a Marine veteran, probably the angriest man I know. I hate to say that. He's my oldest brother. But what separates people who are conscience-stricken afterwards from people who still believe this is the right thing to do?
Well, I mean, this is something that actually came up at those Winter Soldier hearings. Almost every one of the guys or women that spoke at this hearing, to one degree or another, said that they thought that what they were going to be a part of was something positive. And what was interesting was that they were showing slides, some of them from the Marines, some from the Army, some from National Guard units, of themselves. Many of them put up like a slide of themselves in their uniform in one of Saddam's palaces or next to a village or next to a car that they had just shot up. And there are these sort of chilling pictures of a proud soldier smiling into a camera. And they say that this was before I woke up. And for some of them, it took them a few years removed from their time there to sort of make sense of everything that they had been a part of. And some of these soldiers talked about that struggle that you're raising there, where think of how profound of a decision that is to ultimately say something I was just a part of and lost a part of myself doing was wrong, completely, deeply wrong, morally wrong, but potentially even a violation of international law. So I think that it's important for all of us to keep the door open for all of the veterans who have served over there, because listening to the stories of people that went through that process themselves, a lot of people, it takes a moment of meeting someone else, or it takes reading something at some point, or a nightmare that you've had. One guy talked about how he just woke up one morning and it just hit him. I cannot believe I did this. And you look at it and you say, well, that sounds so kind of insane. But the whole thing is insane. You know, they don't recognize a part of themselves that was three sustained years of their lives. And, I mean, you know, the thing that was really moving, too, is there were a lot of Vietnam war vets that were there that said we didn't have the support we needed when we came out against the war. And we were dealing with post-traumatic stress and alcoholism and all of these horrible things that we have been a part of. And we want to be here to support these young people. And I think we have to keep – we always have to keep ourselves open that conversion to this kind of approach where you say, I don't want to be a part of this anymore. For some people, it can be a very painful, long internal process.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. The other thing that you go kind of crazy with this, Jeremy, is when you look at those numbers of the people in America who don't support this war,
right.
it resulted in midterm elections that changed the nature of Congress. So we got 3/4 of the American people opposed to a war that's gone off for 5 years now. We're entering the sixth year. And you have to wonder, where are we in all of this? Why is it that change, there is no significant change? That's a huge number of Americans who are not in favor of the policy.
I mean, perhaps the crowning achievement of Nancy Pelosi's Congress has been to obtain an approval rating lower than that of President Bush. And I think that it's a clear indicator that they're not enacting the wishes of the American people in the Congress. I do think, though, if there was ever a moment in recent history where the Democrats had an opportunity to differentiate themselves from the Republicans, it was after that those elections in 2006 that you're referring to. And with the exception of a few sort of Lone Ranger congresspeople, we haven't seen much action on the war coming from the Democrats. Is that going to play into the November elections? I don't know. John McCain's numbers are pretty solid against either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. Some polls show him leading by 8-9 points against both of them. I also think, and this is sort of, you know, insider politics, but I do think that there's going to be a real crisis in the Democratic Party if Hillary Clinton somehow wins the nomination, because I think a lot of the people that Obama has pulled into this are not necessarily going to go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. I do not think it's a shoo-in that the Democrats are going to win in November. I think that if there's one thing that the Bush machine has shown, it's their ability to maintain power by any means necessary, and they've now adopted John McCain. And people need to be very vigilant in pushing the Democrats to take a position on the war that is much more clear than John Kerry's was in 04, for instance. I think that's why John Kerry lost in 04, was that he made the mistake of playing to the right. John Kerry should have gone to his base. He could have energized people in this country by coming out and being the person he was in 1971 at the Winter Soldier hearings, or the person that he was in the 80s when he was leading the charge against the dirty wars in Central America. I mean, Obama, everything about his history indicates that he should be someone who stands with the anti-war movement. He was against the war from the beginning. That's certainly true. Be against it now when it actually matters. You know, Hillary Clinton is right when she criticizes Obama. Obama's voted to fund that war for years. At times when the decision was made to stand with people like Dennis Kucinich or Jan Schakowsky, the brave congresswoman out of Illinois, Obama didn't fall in line with them. He fell in line with the Democratic establishment. It's important for his supporters to say, Obama, we want you to be the person who gave that speech 4 years ago.
Interesting. And what about, you've written about this as well, what are their positions on the private contractors in Iraq?
This is interesting because Barack Obama actually has been a real leader on this issue in the Senate. In February of 2007, this is before, well, certainly you had reported on Blackwater, Kathleen, but before most of the U.S. media had awoken to the Blackwater issue, before Nisr Square, where Blackwater operatives killed 17 Iraqi civilians last September 16th, Barack Obama introduced legislation that basically sought to hold contractors accountable for crimes committed abroad. He wanted to expand U.S. law to say if a contractor murders someone in Iraq, they should be prosecuted in a U.S. court back in the United States. Now, I was critical of some components of his legislation, but Obama, to his credit, was very awake on this issue and put forward legislation that now has become the Democrats' approach. Hillary Clinton has been on the Armed Services Committee of the Senate since 2003 and has been missing in action and words on this issue for the entire duration of her time on the Armed Services Committee. On February 28th, I did an article for The Nation, where I interviewed Barack Obama's senior foreign policy advisors. And what they told me was that Barack Obama will not rule out using armed private contractors like Blackwater in Iraq. And they said that the reality is we wouldn't be able to implement our Iraq plan without it. And it's true if you look at Obama's Iraq plan. Hillary Clinton's people for 10 straight days would not provide me any comment, any policy position statement, nothing. They just avoided me or said, we're going to call you back. We need to find the right person. The day after my piece comes out saying Obama won't rule out using them and Obama will not sign on to Jan Schakowsky's legislation to try to ban Blackwater, Hillary Clinton's Senate office releases a statement saying Hillary Clinton is supporting Jan Schakowsky's legislation and supports a ban on Blackwater. She then attacks Barack Obama in her St. Patrick's Day speech, quoting my article saying, and Senator Obama won't rule out using private contractors in Iraq, I will. Obama then goes back on her and says, you know, you've been missing on this issue for years. The reality is this. Hillary Clinton became or has become the most important U.S. political figure now to call for a ban on Blackwater. And I think it shows that we can get results if we push on this issue. But how much of a legislative priority it's going to be for her? And I think it's a very serious question. Is this politicking? Is she trying to win favor in the anti-war movement? I don't know. Barack Obama has much more credibility than her on this issue. But I really wish that Obama would now join her in calling for a ban on Blackwater, which I think he's unlikely to do.
Don from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Continuing, first of all, I want to promote your book. It's not a liberal screed. It's a well-documented,
yes, it is,
historical piece of evidence. But would you tell the story of Rhonda Teague, whose husband, Mike Teague, was one of the contractors killed, and how she read your book and what her comments were?
Well, you know, one of the things, and Kathleen certainly knows this because we've talked about it before, I've gotten to know the families of some of the guys who worked for Blackwater who died in Iraq, in particular the four guys who were killed in Fallujah in March of 2004. The mothers of two of those guys, Donna Zavko and Katie Halvenston, have really shown themselves to be incredibly brave people, just to put it very bluntly. They were not political people at all. Their sons were killed, and all of a sudden they were thrust into this position of investigating the murky world of private security companies. Rhonda Teague's husband had been a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, longtime career military guy, joined up with Blackwater and ended up on the mission that day. And Rhonda Teague is a pretty conservative person herself. She's pretty young, lives down in Tennessee. I met her in Washington, D.C., in February of 2007, when those families went to testify in front of Henry Waxman's committee. And at the time, Rhonda Teague was, and others from the Fallujah families sort of had a perception of Iraq that was off in terms of their understanding of the culture in Iraq. It almost seemed like they thought it was Pakistan or Afghanistan. And so I developed a relationship with Rhonda Teague, Donna Zavko, Katie Halvenston, and we had a very vibrant dialogue about my time in Iraq also. And Rhonda Teague said to me at one point, you know, I used to basically look at the Iraqis as monsters, and after reading your book and the stories you told about the time leading up to Mike Teague's death, I see it very differently now. Mm. And to me, that was one of my proudest moments on this, because their opinions matter a lot to me because they've lost a lot in this story.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Thank you, John.
You bet.
Dave is next from Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi. You know, there's one thing I agree on, that if there's atrocities over in Iraq and some people are doing the wrong thing, I believe those people should be punished for their actions. But for someone who disagrees with you on everything else, I mean, I look at this Iraq war and it's like, I look at it and I'm like, okay, he broke 17 UN resolutions. He was bribing the UN and for the UN oil for food scandal. He was killing and massacring his own people. He was seeking chemical weapons. He was seeking stuff to get his nuclear program going. He was funding terrorism. He was harboring terrorists. He was funding.
Who were the terrorists he was harboring?
He was funding the Egyptian Islamic Jihadists, which was run by al-Zahiri, which is al-Qaeda. They have documents showing in the Pentagon study that he was funding and supporting Ansar al-Islam up in the north. He was funding the guys in Afghanistan that were the warlord that owned the place in Afghanistan where al-Qaeda was.
Okay, you've done a good job of giving Dick Cheney's fifth anniversary of the Iraq invasion speech, where almost everything that you've said there has been so thoroughly discredited and debunked. I mean, the fact that you would raise the Ansar al-Islam issue, I find very curious. Just so people understand what you're talking about here or what you think you're talking about, Ansar al-Islam was the al-Qaeda presence in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was president. I'm not sure if the caller is aware of the fact that Ansar al-Islam operated out of the Kurdish section of Iraq, which was controlled by the United States and its allies. Saddam Hussein's forces were regularly engaged in battles with them. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were absolute enemies. The Ba'ath Party was an Arab nationalist institution that was completely against what Osama bin Laden was supporting. And the fact is that you've just given a litany of basically lies and falsehoods that have been repeated over and over by Dick Cheney, by Stephen Hayes in the Weekly Standard, by people who have been so thoroughly discredited. And the reality is right now, in a bigger picture to all of the falsehoods that you just threw out there, if the Standard – for U.S. intervention was everything that you just listed there, the United States would have invaded Israel a long time ago, would have invaded Turkey a long time ago. What you're describing there, that pattern of defiance of the United Nations, the attempts to seek chemical weapons and nuclear weapons, describes some of the United States' closest allies. And it also describes our country as well. And so if the standard is all of the things that you said, the United States is going to be invading countries around the world left and right, including its own. The reality is Iraq posed no threat to the United States whatsoever. And Iraqis, I was there at the time of Saddam Hussein, Iraqis were praying that that guy was just going to croak so that they could figure out a different way forward. This was the worst case scenario for the people of Iraq.
Thanks very much for the call. One more very quick call. We have a minute left, everybody. Tom from Beloit. Hi.
Hi. I'm a European, and I'm very happy that I can hear this kind of discussion on the public radio, because democracy is a discussion. And generally, I don't want to judge your policy all over the world. I would like to say only that as far as I'm concerned, the biggest asset, the biggest asset of American policy always was no army, was American dream, the way of life he conducted over here. The freedom, the possibility of opportunities, raise family in peace, things like that. All that actually was destroyed during the last 8 years.
Okay, Jeremy, we have a few seconds.
Well, I actually just want to thank you, Kathleen, for having me on so many times and for being on this story before a lot of media outlets were. And it's an honor to be here honoring the life of Frank Seidler, because on a big level, I'm looking at Blackwater and the privatization of the war machine. On a small level, it was exactly what Frank Seidler was battling against here in Milwaukee. He wanted public parks, public schools, public media, public education. Those things were losing day and day and day. And I'm honored to be a part of honoring Frank Seidler's legacy and being back here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, you're a perfect person to give the first memorial address. Thanks, Jeremy, so much.
Thank you. See
you when you're in town again. Jeremy Scahill, he is giving the Frank Seidler memorial address. It's the first, and it's tonight at 7:30 at Central Library, which is located in downtown Milwaukee. It's free, and it's open to the public, and it's bound to be quite a good night. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll return following the news from National Public Radio.